Now we get to the free-to-air presentation of the Dhamma. So, I hope you enjoyed your lunch. I was talking with the Venerable here. How surprised I was. Well, as a monk, you only eat one meal a day or two meals a day at most. We only eat a tiny bit. And I couldn't believe just how much all our lay people ate. And you're going to eat about four or five times a day. But doesn't matter. No, you can't. Not the ones upstairs anywhere. They're in the high realms. In this realm, maybe. This may be a lower realm. But, as my teacher Ajahn Chah said, just that's only food for the body. The most important meal is happening now because this is food for the heart. And just like in our modern world, that sometimes we have junk food and sometimes we have health food. It's the same with the things which you put in your mind. Sometimes it's junk food for the mind. You know what that is? Junk food for the mind? TV. And health food for the mind, what's that? Dhamma, yes. So this is going on a health food for the mind retreat. So having fed your body, now we're going to feed your mind. Because the topic for this afternoon's session is anicca. What do I actually call it? Impermanence, or actually a little bit more than impermanence. Now you must have already noticed just how fast things disappear from your plate. So there was a great teaching of the impermanence of things. And you notice the joy, the happiness of the taste. It's there for a moment and then it's gone. And sometimes the expectation, anticipation is the most delicious. Can you imagine now just your favorite food? Your favorite bowl of noodles. Can you see it now? Can you smell it? It's the anticipation for many people is the happy part. And as soon as you get it, oh, it just goes away so quickly. When I was a young monk, just gone to Thailand, everything which I was used to had disappeared. The climate was strange. The language was strange. And the food was strange too. Even the first 2 days when I asked the way, where's the toilet? They took me to a room. And I said, this isn't the toilet, there's nowhere to sit down. It was an Asian toilet and I didn't understand. And so many, many, many things were different, and especially the food. And so after a little while, 2 or 3 days, I started getting homesick. I started thinking of fish and chips. What you eat in England. And then I realized, hang on, I've been a vegetarian for the last 3 years. Even when I could have it, I never did. But then, after I think 7 years as a monk, I went back home to visit my mother. And I thought, ah, at last, after 7 years of Thai food, I can get some English food. Maybe I'll get some chips. And as soon as I went into my mother's house, it was a strange thing what happens with desire and craving. Sometimes, and when you crave something, it always goes wrong. She had a special pan which she fried the chips in. I've known it for years and years. In English cuisine, you never throw away that chip pan or clean it. The older it is, the more delicious the chips. But as soon as I walked in, the first thing she said was, you know, I've always been wanting to throw away that pan. And she throwed it away right in front of my eyes. And I thought, oh my goodness, so close, yet so far. But finally I did get some chips. A Thai man gave them to me. And you know what I found out? They did not taste as nice as I dreamt. Oh, what a letdown. Because it's the trouble with our desires. As soon as we have them, we don't want them anymore. Even our desires are impermanent, unreliable. And so it's great to be able to contemplate just how these things, they come and they go and they come. And they're just little desires. It's a waste of time giving them more importance than they really need. And the thing is that when we don't understand the ebb and flow of life, the ephemeral nature of our experiences, of our friends, we don't understand that these things are going anyway. We might as well let them go. We've got no choice because they're saying goodbye. We might as well wave goodbye too. But when we don't understand that, what happens is we get attached and we think we own these things, and that is the cause of suffering. Sometimes I ask myself, Ajahn Brahm, what do you own? And you don't own much at all. Do you own your house? Do you own your car? Do you own your family? Whatever you own is what we attach to. And that is a cause of suffering. I've been teaching this for many years. And one of my disciples, the only thing of value he owned was a Harley Davidson motorcycle. It was worth about 30 or 40,000 Australian dollars. It was a classic old model, which was worth a lot. He only lived in a rented apartment. He only had ordinary clothes. That was the one thing which he had was of value, which he could not part with. And he told me once he went shopping. He parked his expensive bike in the shopping center and went down to buy some things. And when he returned, it was gone. Someone had stolen it. And he looked and he thought, that's the only thing I own of value, the only thing which I really like, and now it's stolen. And he remembered all the teachings of Buddhism, and he said, Anicca. He let it go, and he was so at peace. And as soon as he let it go, he felt so much happiness. He'd really understood the Dhamma. He felt, you know, almost half enlightened. It's a strange thing what happens when you get it right, and you understand the Dhamma. The next thing he noticed was he was on the wrong level of the car park. He went down the next level, there was his bike, hadn't been stolen at all. But it was a great experience for him. He was tested out and he won. Good on him. So it was a test to see if he understood impermanence of all your possessions. Because why worry? They come to you and they go. The share market goes up, the share market goes down. And then it goes up again. We always call them yo-yo markets. But this is just our life. When we understand about what impermanence is, that things are always changing. When we understand and we adapt to the reality of life, then we don't need to suffer so much. The suffering is, as I said this morning, when we don't understand reality, we have unrealistic expectations of life. So it's great to know that things pass, that we have our loved ones come into our life, and then they leave again. Sometimes you look at your children. Where do they come from? You don't know where your children come from. You get pregnant, there's a boy or girl in there, but you don't know where they've been before. Really what it's like is inviting someone into your house for 18 or 19 years from the street. You don't know where they're from or who they are. That's what you do with your children. They come with their own karma from the previous places. And they stay with you a while, and then they leave again. Really, you should know that from the very beginning. That your job is just to nurture them for 18, 19, 20 years. And then once they got their degree, then you should kick them out and say goodbye. But how many of you can do that? Can't you be like the birds? The birds are so wise. They really look after their young. They sit on the eggs for such a long time. If you think that you've got a sore bottom sitting in here just for one day, imagine what it's like to be a bird. They even haven't even got a cushion to sit on. Imagine sitting on an egg. It's the wrong shape to make your bottom feel good. But they've got to sit on that egg until it hatches, and as soon as it hatches, they've got to fly around, frying worms and all sorts of other things for their chicks. And they teach their chickens how to fly, and once their little chicks fly, then that's it. Bye-bye. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be like that? As soon as your children were old enough, boot, out you go. See you later. Unfortunately, that many parents these days, they keep their children in the house for such a long time, and the children like staying with their parents for such a long time. There's apparently even a movie about that I saw in the newspaper today, or on the plane coming in here. I forget what the movie was called. It's all about a boy who was staying with his mum, about 30 or 35 years of age, and hadn't moved out at all. But to realize that these people don't belong to us, they are impermanent, they go according to their karma, we go according to our karma, if we can only realize that they will leave, that things change, that then we will be free. I was telling a lady who was in trouble last night, that no matter how she's feeling now, it will always change. There was the story of the Emperor's Ring, which is a wonderful story which helps heal many people's pain and suffering in this world. A long time ago, there was a young man who took over a kingdom. Being a young man, he wasn't all that skillful in running the business of a kingdom. So every time the kingdom was going well and there was prosperity and people were happy, he would hold celebrations, Commonwealth Games, parties, Asian Games, whatever it was. He would hold parties and celebrations. And because he was spending so much money in celebrations and spending so much time enjoying himself and allowing other people to enjoy themselves, the economy of the country didn't last very long, or the good economy didn't last very long. The good times didn't last long at all. And when there was problems in the country, when there was unhappiness amongst the people, and the economy was not going well, and everyone was unhappy, he was so upset himself that he was spending so much time in his room sulking and getting miserable and getting depressed. And because of that, the bad times seemed to last longer than usual. So he was not a very good ruler. But the ministers, his advisors, they were very sharp. I think they were sort of presidents of the Buddhist Zen Fellowship or something like that. So they went up to their king, or they met together and they came up with a plan. What they did was to ask one of the jewelers to make a special gold ring for the ruler. It was an ordinary gold ring except for the words on the outside, which were engraved very clearly. The words, "This too will pass. This too will pass." And so, having engraved it on the ring, they presented it to their ruler and asked him to wear it on all occasions. And because he wore it on all occasions, he would keep looking at it. So when times were difficult, when there was problems in the kingdom, when there was so many things to do to fix up, he would always look at that ring. Remember, this too will pass. It won't always be this bad. But he would also look at the ring in the good times as well, to realize in times of health and prosperity and happiness and comfort that this too will pass as well. Well, that meant that when during the bad times, he never got that upset or depressed that he wouldn't do any work. This too will pass gave him hope. And hope gave him inspiration to work, to try, to endeavor. And what happened was the bad times never lasted so long. And whenever there was good times, he realized that this is also impermanent, doesn't always like this. And so he would work. He would endeavor, he would strive. Even in the good times, he would not rest. And that way, the good times lasted so long. The bad times lasted so short that he became a very, very successful ruler, loved by everybody. And this is a simile of our lives, because we are the ruler of our body, of our family, of our little area. And sometimes we experience some suffering, some difficulties. And what do most people do? Oh, they get depressed and they sulk and they get miserable and they don't do anything, which means the bad times last longer than they should. So whenever there's any difficulty, always remember this too will pass. But also when things are going well, always remember this too will pass. And when you remember that, you will always put all the energy and effort you possibly can into this moment. Because this moment is so valuable, and you won't let it pass without enjoying it. And if it gets difficult, doesn't matter, it will pass. As Ajahn Chah, what I said the other night, went to tell me when I was sick in the hospital, with a bad fever, feeling miserable, feeling in a third world hospital, in a place such a long way from home. I think I was a 24-year-old man, a monk. So weak, so terrible. And the teacher came in. Imagine you were sick, and say the chief priest came to see you. Chief Reverend came all the way from Bickfields. He's old and sick himself, but he comes to see you. Oh, you'd be so honored and so privileged. You'd feel so good. But actually, I have to be very careful now. Because when I go and visit people in hospital, because I'm very, very busy, if I walk into someone's room and they're in bed, they get very worried. Why is Ajahn Brahm coming to see me? Is it something the doctor hasn't said? Ah, I'm dying, I'm dying. So I've got to be very careful if I go and see someone in hospital, because they think I'm so busy, I can only be visiting them if it's really important. But if the chief reverend came and see you. This is what it was like when Ajahn Chah came to see me. But you all know what he said when he came to see me. I was happy for a second when I saw him. And when he said what he said, I got really depressed again. Because what he said is, Brahma Wang, sir, you'll either get better or you'll die. Either way, your sickness isn't going to last. It's anicca. I didn't want my sickness to last, but I wanted to last. And that was a problem there, but it was so truthful. So whenever you're in sickness or in pain, always remember, this too will pass. And if you remember that, it gives you strength, it gives you hope, so you never get really depressed. Even when you are depressed, because depression is a huge problem for many people in this world, always remember it won't stay the same. You'll either get worse, or it'll get better. But it'll never stay the same, and it usually doesn't get worse. So what we can do there, this too will pass, gives us hope, gives us energy, gives us a way of looking forward to the, and the truth of the fact is, it doesn't last. Sometimes, I never said this morning, but I sometimes was wondering about the happiest moments in people's lives. And sometimes people say the happiest moment in their life is when they get married. The day when I got married was the happiest time in my life. And why is that? And I noticed that what real happiness is always like the pause between two moments of suffering. That's why getting married is the happiest moment of life, because all the suffering of finding a partner and arranging the marriage, that's a lot of suffering. And then you have the marriage ceremony, and then you have the suffering which comes afterwards. But it's true, one of the happiest times of which I saw was must have been about 20 years ago. I was meeting someone in the airport in Perth, and this group of refugees came through. They were Baha'i refugees. After the Iranian Revolution, they were persecuted and driven from the country, and they lost everything. Many of their family were killed or tortured. And they finally, after staying some time in refugee camps, I think in Pakistan, they were resettled in Australia. And as they came through the customs after passing the immigration, and they came into Australia, they literally leapt in the air and punched the air. Yeah, they made it. Freedom. No, future prosperity. They could practice their religion. They weren't going to be tortured. And after a while, the people coming through, all their friends were cheering. And then suddenly I found myself cheering as well, until I realized I wasn't a Baha'i. I was trying to meet somebody else. But the joy was infectious. And these were such happy people. And I started to reflect afterwards, why were they so happy? And the reflection came that the degree of their happiness was a measure of the suffering they just passed through. If they hadn't been tortured, if they hadn't have lost all their friends and their money, they wouldn't have felt so happy coming into the country. Their happiness was a measure of the suffering which had gone before. And I also, sometimes you see in the newspaper, celebrations after someone wins the FA Cup, or they win the World Cup soccer, or they finally get a gold medal in the Olympics. And I sometimes wonder, why do they have so much happiness? It's only because of the amount of suffering which went before. I don't know if any of you do follow sport, but it's the most stupid thing to follow. Look at this, they're coming to have the Soccer World Cup. Don't go see the Soccer World Cup in June. Come to Perth. For our global conference instead. And we didn't realize that when we were scheduling this, it's just at the beginning of the World Cup soccer. That was a big mistake. But look at the World Cup soccer. I think 32 teams are going to go. Where's it going to be held? In Germany. 32 teams are going to go to Germany. 31 teams are going to come back home miserable. Even the one which gets to the final and loses at the last hurdle, they're the ones who suffer the most. So close, yet so far. And the team which does win, they got 1 or 2 days happiness and it's back to suffering again. Oh, you've got a 32-1 chance of losing. That doesn't seem good odds to me. But if you come to Perth for our conference, you've got a 100-0 chance of winning. But why is it that people get so happy when their team wins? Because of all the suffering which went before. When you look at the happiness and sufferings of life, isn't it what you take to be happiness? It's just some suffering ending. That happiness is a pause between two moments of suffering. And suffering is a pause between two moments of happiness. I sometimes reflected upon that when I started to think of the concept of a heaven. How can you have a heaven world? If it was always beautiful and nice, you would not notice it anymore. Because the nature of our consciousness is always to compare. If you had beautiful food every day, you wouldn't notice it. If you had a beautiful aircon every day, it's only when it didn't work you would notice it. You notice after a while of reflection that even if you were in heaven, after a while it would not be happiness anymore. You take it for granted. And I remembered a Christian theologian, I think in the Middle Ages, once said that in the Christian heaven, one day every year you get taken to hell. Otherwise, you would not appreciate what heaven was like. It was a wonderful way of understanding what happiness and suffering really is. It is inherent in the happiness and suffering that we have differences, changes. Otherwise, we would just not know what is beauty, what is ugliness, what is happiness, what is suffering. By its very nature, heaven has to be impermanent. By its very nature, hell has to be impermanent. Otherwise, you get used to it. I remember reading a very moving book some years ago. It was called Prisoner Without a Name, Soul Without a Number. It was a story of a journalist who'd been interned in Argentina during the times of the generals. During that military junta, many activists, left-wing journalists disappeared in the middle of the night and were killed or tortured by the military regime of that time. This was a journalist who always walked a very dangerous line in his articles, and one day it happened in the middle of the night. The secret police came for him and took him away and put him in his underground cells where he was tortured. It was only the fact that he was quite a well-known journalist and had friends in the United States who were contacted by his wife that they didn't actually kill him. He survived. And after he survived, he wrote this book about his experiences. But the most interesting part of his book was saying after months and months in these jails, being tortured on electric shock machines and beaten, he said the worst pain of the whole time came when the guards handed over a letter from his wife. He had told his wife, if ever I disappear, please don't try to contact me. He had got used to that deprivation, to that pain, to being in prison. The letter from his wife brought back the contrast. He remembered the life in a warm and loving family. He had something to compare his present torment with. And he said that was the worst pain of all. It's why, in the old way of trying to extract information from people, we always have the good cop, bad cop routine. Without the good cop, the bad cop doesn't hurt so much. You find that within happiness and pain, it is the contrast which is important. Even in pain in hell, you will not notice that until every now and again there is some happiness. This is the whole story of this man, because of some bad karma, was taken down to hell. He was shown three rooms. The first room, that people were being, it was so hot, people were boiling, and even without clothes on, they were sweating, and it was so uncomfortable. It was a hot room. He said, "Do you like that?" And he said, "No, I hate the heat." So they took him into the second hell room. And the second hell room, it was just so cold, people were freezing. It's like being in sort of Antarctica. And he said, "Do you want that?" And he said, "No, no, no. That's too cold. I hate the cold." They took him into the third room. In the third room, people were standing up to their necks in this filth, you know, in excrement and terrible stuff. But they were having cups of tea. And he always liked his tea. So he said, "Okay, I'll take that room." So he went into that room, and they stood up there in the filth. It smelled awful, and they gave him a cup of tea. And he hadn't finished his tea yet before the guard said, "Okay, boys, tea break over, back on your heads." Even in hell, they have a tea break. Now, the point of that story is that without comparisons, you would not understand just what happiness and pain truly is. Anicca is part of all this. So, but anyhow, once one understands the impermanence of all things, this too will pass. It actually helps us understand the reality of life and actually how to deal with things. We can enjoy things while they're here, but we always understand why they're here. They're not going to be here forever. If we can understand that from the start, then we understand the Dhamma. Many times Ajahn Chah would hold up a cup. And he would hold up a cup and say, "Do you see the crack in this glass or this cup?" And I thought it was crazy. "This has got no crack in this glass or this cup." He said, "There is one there, but it's microscopic. You can't see it yet, but it's there. One day, because someone will drop this cup or they will kick it over, that crack will expand and this will break. It's got a crack in it, remember?" He said, "Because it's got a crack in it, you know it's impermanent, subject to break." He said, "That's why you care. If this was made out of some unbreakable plastic, which would survive a nuclear explosion and last to the end of the eon or beyond," he said, "you wouldn't need to care for this cup. You could kick it, you could drop it, you could throw it around, it wouldn't break. But because it's got a crack in it, that is why you care." And then he pointed to me and said, "See that monk over there? He's got a crack in him as well." You may not see it yet, but But one day that crack will open up and I will die. Each one of you are cracked. One day that crack will open up and you will die too. Your children, your loved ones. Because you've got a crack in you, because that one day that will open up and you die, that is why you care. People who contemplate anicca, impermanence, they don't become cold and heartless. The more you contemplate the ephemeral nature of all things, that things one day will pass, the more compassionate you become. Because all your loved ones have got a crack in them, that's why you handle them gently and you care for them. I learned that lesson when my father cracked when he died. Because he died when I was only 16 years of age, I felt very guilty. I was a young man growing up, and it's a nature of young men growing up, it's going through their adolescence, to compete with their father. You are men, males, it's just in your genes. And so I was competing with my father. The way I would argue with him, he liked Frank Sinatra. That was his generation. I liked Jimi Hendrix. So when he put on his Frank Sinatra records, I put on my Jimi Hendrix records. Jimi Hendrix was much louder than Frank Sinatra. So I won. And a little thing like that, you would think that was just a teenager growing up. When he died, I felt so guilty about that. I thought, what did I do that for? I loved that man and cared for him. Why did he just do a stupid, idiotic thing like stop his enjoyment of the music he liked? But now it was too late. My father had died. That taught me a lesson. You can't afford to hurt anybody, especially the people in your family. You don't know how long they're going to be there. And if you have hurt them, you can't wait until tomorrow to say sorry. You can't wait until later on today to say how much you care for them. You have to say it now because of anicca. Things change. Opportunities pass. It's not always here. It's gone. What a great shame that is. That's why it's important to understand the sort of the ephemeral nature of things. It makes life more important. It's like the story of this friend of mine who was a businessman in Sydney, a very successful businessman. He wasn't a Buddhist, but I think he became a tantamount to one after this experience. Just a few days after his annual medical checkup, he received a phone call from his doctor. It was a personal friend. The first words of the doctor were, "Is your wife at home?" Why would a doctor say that? It's like Ajahn Brahm coming to visit you in hospital. Something is wrong. So straight away, that's what he said. What's wrong? Actually, my wife is here. Good, said the doctor. I'm sorry to report that you have got some results of your blood test back from the lab. You've got a rare type of blood cancer. I'm sorry to say it's untreatable and terminal. This man thought he was in the best of health. Like most people when they get these shocks from their doctor. You think you're fine, and now you finally find out you've got a cancer. What most people would say, and what he said, was, "How long have I got to live?" You know that doctors can't answer that. I know this one man who went to see his doctor, and the doctor told him, "I'm sorry, sir, you've only got 1 month to live." His reply was, "Doctor, I don't think I can pay your bills within 1 month." "Okay," said the doctor, "I'll give you 2 months to live." Business is business after all. So, this man, the doctor actually told him, so this one is a true story, not the joke. The doctor actually told him, maybe 2 months, if you're lucky, 3, but unlikely 4. It gave him a time span. He was that close to death. What he did when he realized such impermanence of his life, that he was only going to live a few more months, he changed the priorities of his life. He'd always promised his family to take them on a trip to Europe. You know what it's like, all the promises you make? You promise me you'll come and see me in Perth for the conference. Now he had to go. There was no time to dither. He actually sold his business. For those of you in business, if you sell a business very quickly, you never get a good price. But he was very lucky, he got a fair price for his business. He said, no, it's quite fortunate. He bought tickets for him and his family. When it's the last time, money is no object. He bought first class tickets for him and his family in the best hotels. This was the last time for him and his family to enjoy their company. And he was holding the tickets in the hand, so the story goes, when the telephone rang again. It was a doctor. I don't know how to tell you this, said the doctor. 2 men, same surname, wrong results. You are perfectly healthy. A true story happened. Yeah, no, you may have heard stories like this. Even in medicine, sometimes mistakes do happen. Unfortunately, but they do. And because of that, he never sued that doctor. He never got angry at him. In fact, he calls that doctor like his guru, his teacher. Because he went on that holiday with his family, had a wonderful time. Now we have the opportunity for questions. We have 20 minutes. Is it 20 minutes? No, we have 35 minutes for questions to 2:45. So the time is running out quickly. Any questions while you have the opportunity? Now is your chance. So who's going to ask the first question? On Anicca. Yes, we have one over there.
Well, it's not on Anicca. Back to the first.
Okay, anything, yeah.
My friend asked me about the 3 questions by the emperor.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, if you say the most important person is the person you're with,
yep.
Do you mean the person who's your life partner, or do you mean the person you're with currently?
What I mean, when you ask the question of the most important person in the world is the one you're with, it has to be the one you're with right now, in this moment. Okay. So for the moment, you, madam, are the most important person in the world for me. not now. But now.
Then she said, in that case, if somebody was having an adulterous affair, then that person, the person you're with, is the most important person you're with.
Yeah, for what happens, no. You've got to remember there's 3 questions there, not just one. The most important thing to do is to care, and you're not caring if you're being adulterous.
Oh, read together.
Yeah, you have to put them all together. These are 3 aspects of the most important thing in the world. So, yeah, sure, that's the trouble with people. They're always trying to twist it to suit themselves. That's why that some of my disciples, they've been trying their hardest to keep that 5th precept of not taking alcohol. And now what happens in this world, people actually know more about Buddhism. Just ordinary people know Buddhism as well and what Buddhists are supposed to do. So they go to parties or they go to receptions and they say, no alcohol, please. And they say, what are you talking about? Why no alcohol? They say, because I'm a Buddhist. Oh yeah, we know Buddhists. Let go. Come and let go. Have some alcohol. Don't be attached to your precepts, they say. So you've got to be careful. You've got to understand the full picture. Otherwise, you get it wrong. But no, that story, the Emperor's 3 questions, I know I talk about that a lot, but that's one of those moving ways of describing Dhamma, which is beautiful and perfect. If you want to have a successful life, Practice those Emperor's Three Questions. And the most important is the one you're with. When you're at work with a client, don't try and get rid of them because you're trying to do something else. That client may be very important for you in the future. You don't know who they are. They're the most important person in the world. Give them that attention and they realize somebody cares about me. This company or this person working for the company is listening. And that is a huge for public relations. I say that's one of the keys to my success. Because when somebody asks me a question, I really try and listen. Sometimes I get it wrong. But if you ask that question, I don't care about anybody else in this room. In that moment, you're the most important person in the world. Sometimes at night, people come for counseling or ask questions. I'm really, really tired. It doesn't matter. If someone's asking me a question, they're the most important person in the world for me. I don't worry about bed afterwards. I don't worry about what I've done before. Don't matter if they're a little kid or Queen Elizabeth, whoever it is, they're the most important person in the world. Then you're always successful. You come home, you see your husband. He's the most important person in the world when you're there. Don't take him for granted. Say, oh, he's my husband, I can see him later. I can talk to him later. No, now's the most important time. Please care enough. And the time of your life when you're alone, no one else there, just me, then you are the most important person in the world. That's why, who's the last person you say goodnight to before you go to sleep? Yourself, yeah. Do you still practice that? Before you go to sleep, to say to yourself, good night, me, have a nice rest. I always do that. I got in the habit. I'm saying, good night, me, have a nice rest. You've worked really hard today. Have a good sleep. Does that degree of kindness to yourself, you tend to have a good sleep. And I say that when I wake up in the morning, good morning, me. Hope you have a good day. And that way you're caring for yourself. Okay, I've got some questions here from upstairs. What is the Buddhist view on mercy killing? Okay, sometimes that when you see an animal is suffering, people say they're putting the animal out of its misery. Usually you're putting the animal out of your misery, not out of the animal's misery, which is why sometimes you have the problem of a cat or a dog who's very, very sick. I think I said this yesterday, didn't I? When the cat or the dog is very sick and you have to face the problem, should I take that cat to the vet and have it put down? Let's put it straight. That's what they came, have it put down. It's really being killed. Or should I let it live? And as a Buddhist, that's a very difficult question to answer. If you take it to the vet and have it killed, isn't that breaking your precept of killing living beings? But if you don't take it to the vet, aren't you breaking your vows of compassion and kindness? There's an animal really, really suffering. So it becomes an ethical dilemma for many Buddhists. What should you do? And it comes even worse when that's not a dog, but that's your mother on a ventilator. And the doctors say there's no chance of recovery. But they could, but it may happen. Because sometimes it does happen. Sometimes people say no chance at all, and they do recover. Doctors don't know for sure. But every day they're on that ventilator, thousands of ringgits are being taken out of your account. And you've got other people to care for. You're not ridiculously wealthy. What should you do? And the answer which I give people, because Buddhism is a practical religion, it's not a theoretical religion which has no meaning for people's ordinary lives. I tell anybody, whether it's a dog or a cat or your mother or father on a ventilator, what you should do is to go to their bedside and ask them. Ask your dog, do you want to die? You may think that's a strange question, but those of you who are close to a pet, if you really answer that question sincerely and listen what your heart feels afterwards, you will know the answer. We are in contact with the people we love. not on an intellectual level, but on an emotional level. There's so many stories of people whose, say, daughter has an accident in Los Angeles, and you know there's something wrong here. You can feel it. There's this story I read in the Melbourne Age about this prominent vet in Melbourne who, on the weekend, was going off to a country for a weekend party, and while he was on the road, halfway between Melbourne and this country town in Victoria, he was suddenly overcome with emotion. He was a man, he never experienced this before. He started crying. He had to stop the car by the side of the road, just get outside and weep. And it was just so unnatural for him to do so. He was as confused as he was emotional. It took him 5 minutes to get himself together, get back in his car and feel well enough to carry on driving. He did not know why he had this sudden emotional sadness until he reached the country house. There was a message waiting for him. His dog had been run over by a car at precisely that moment. That's one story out of many, where it may be an animal, it may be a loved one, who suddenly dies and we're a long way from the incident and we know something has happened. We can be in contact with one another. So if that's your mother or your dog or whatever, if you ask the question, you will hear the answer. And sometimes a dog says, I had enough, I can't stand it any longer. Then if you take it to the vet, it's an act of compassion. Sometimes it's your mum on the ventilator. You ask anybody there. The machines might not be able to tell, but if you ask the question and listen carefully, you will know. You'll feel it. She's there. Keep it going. Sometimes you'll hear the answer. No one there. It's empty. You realize then you're just turning off a machine which is keeping a body going, but your mum is gone. It's a beautiful, practical way of dealing with some of the issues of life. The precepts are the guidelines to stop us acting heedlessly. But they're only guidelines, they're not absolutes. Compassion has to override the rules. In the same way that we have rules of traffic law, you're not supposed to go through red lights. But if I had a heart attack in the next 5 minutes, I really hope, Victor, you'll put me in your car and you'd go through every red traffic light you possibly could to get to me in the hospital in time. But if you got to that red light, you'd stop and make sure it was safe and then go through. And no doctor or no sort of policeman would punish you for that. I know one lady, her husband had a heart attack. Instead of calling the ambulance, which would take a while because she was living in a reasonably remote area, she put her husband in the car and rushed to the hospital. She went through many red traffic lights and she was really disappointed the policeman didn't see her. For once, she had a good reason. So that's the Buddhist idea on so-called mercy killing. Not right, not wrong, you've got to ask first of all. See what the dog wants to do, the cat wants to do, or the kangaroo wants. Most animals would rather live than die. They give themselves a chance, they just want to be put under a bush, to be looked after, and they want to see what happens. Sometimes you just don't know what will happen. So that's a great question, thank you for that. Dear Ajahn Brahm, why are we born with cravings? It seems so automatic. A baby cries when born. Is that craving? Now the baby realizes what's in front of it. School, nappies, all sorts of stuff. Is that what you really want again? Do you want to be in nappies again? Do you want to have to go to school all over again? Do you think you're finished with school? If you get reborn again, here we go again. So be careful. So why are we born with cravings? Actually, why are we born at all? Why are you reborn? You know why? Because you want to. You think that next time you can get it right. Next time you can actually marry a good guy instead of that stupid one you got this time. Next time you can get a nice girl, someone who's really soft and kind and always do what you're told. Get real. That's what we do. We fantasize and think that next time we've learnt a bit more, we'll get it, do it much better next time. But the point is, it's not the case. It's always the same. So that's why we're born with cravings, because of ignorance. It seems so automatic. A baby cries when born. Is that craving? It's not. It's realization. It's wisdom. Am I right to think that craving is inborn? What is its purpose? Again, craving comes from ignorance, not really understanding the truth, thinking that when we get what we want, then we'll be happy. And you've done enough craving all this time, everything you've hoped for, everything you've wanted, everything you've strived for. Some of you have got it, and it's not what you really wanted. Some of you haven't got it, but trust other people, when you do get it, it's not that much anyway. Some people want to be famous, and I'm getting famous now, and it's terrible. Because I told you about the toilet attendant in Changi Airport the other day. This is when I was coming back from Los Angeles, a long flight, you know, via Singapore, and you're sitting in an aircraft, I don't know for how many hours, 17 hours or something. And when I got to Singapore, there was my disciples waiting for me, because they're flight attendants, they work for Singapore Airlines. They go inside. So, you know, they were actually waiting at the gate for me. And they took me into the lounge and they were asking me questions on Dhamma. Taking photographs. You know what it's like? One more question. And so I thought, I get away from everyone, have a bit of peace and quiet. Now, what is an exercise? So I said, okay, enough now. I'm going to just walk, you know, the length of the terminal, walk back and forth to get some exercise. So I said goodbye to everyone and started walking, hadn't got about 20 minutes. Ajahn Brahm, what are you doing here? Can I ask a question on Dhamma, please? And before I got to the end of the terminal, three people had stopped me and had long conversations for 20 minutes each. So next time I go to Chang'an, I'm going to get a wig. The dark glasses, maybe a false beard, and go incognito. your blue suit. So the trouble is that sometimes people, they want to be famous, and when they're famous, they're unhappy. So all the craving which you have in life, now this is sometimes you think, what am I doing this for? It's purpose. It's a waste of time. So it's much better just to sort of be at ease with life. If fame comes to you, fine. If it doesn't come to you, fine. If rich wealth comes to you, fine. If it doesn't come to you, fine. Success or lack of success, it's all the same. It's just your attitude towards it is what makes it happiness or not happiness. It's not the world which causes happiness or suffering. It's your attitude to what you experience causes happiness or suffering. It's an attitude problem. Get the attitude right, whether you're famous or whether you're infamous, whether you're in jail or you're in a monastery or in your mansion or in a hovel. If you understand the right attitude, then you're at peace. So you don't have to give up your position. You don't have to try and get a better position. Make peace with it. And that's the way you can stop craving. What will happen if all human beings become monks? Quite easy, because only men become monks. That means all the women have to work hard to bring us dana. Then they say, what happens if all the women become nuns? That used to be a problem. But nowadays, have you seen all these robots and cyborgs? It'd be really great, because, you know, the robots can actually feed us all, and the cyborgs can do all the work. So in the future, maybe only 10 or 20 years, everybody can become a monk or a nun. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing? Actually, I made this point because the modern economies, because of the problem with greenhouse gases and global warming, they have these greenhouse credits, for companies. And as a monk, I want to claim one. Because as a monk, I am not creating any babies. And babies create a lot of greenhouse usage. So by being celibate, not creating babies, I demand lots and lots of greenhouse credits. Because what's the most important or the most difficult problem facing our world? It's overpopulation. That's the cause of many sort of environmental problems. The lack of water in many countries. They would call it the ecological footprint of our world. Trying to find enough food and space for people to live. I am doing my part to solve the problem of overpopulation. The more monks and nuns we have, the less problem we have with overpopulation. That's why I think the government should subsidize monks and nuns. We're helping their infrastructure. Okay, so that's what will happen if human beings, all everyone become monks. It'll be a wonderful world. Buddhism practices moderation, middle path. Buddhists can never be a CEO since they never have the desire or crave to take. Is it true? Is it to take or to talk or is it to fake? The CEO does not mean chief executive officer. It means the chief enlightened one. If that's the case, the monks can be CEOs. Our children come to us with their karmic imprint. Does our own karma have any effect on our children's karma? That's a great question. Yeah, it does, because karma is always interacting, it's always growing, it's a work in progress, it's not a final thing. And it's great to understand that, because what that means is no matter what karma you start out with, you can always make some more karma and actually to deal with it, to mold it, to turn even bad ingredients into a wonderful life. So I keep on saying that simile of the cake. What you have to deal with is the ingredients. How you put those ingredients together for a meal or to make a house or whatever, that's your responsibility. Your friends, your relations, your parents, your monks, they can all help you. So my good karma is affecting you. We do interact. Whenever this is actually one of the reasons why I really worked hard in my meditation in my early years, because I realized whatever I did was not just for me. If I really understood Dhamma, if I got some wisdom, got some compassion going, then that would affect a lot of other people. So when I meditated, it wasn't just for me, it was for others as well. So our karma does interact. So yeah, the children come with their karmic input, with their ingredients, and you help them to make something of their ingredients. Sometimes children come, they're not so beautiful, not so intelligent. Sometimes they're even physically not a full body. But you can still let them make a beautiful cake out of what they've got. It's wonderful actually to see that. I've seen some people who are, sometimes brain damaged, sometimes they're physically deformed. And they make wonderful lives out of what they've got. And I've seen other people. One of my friends at school, he's one of the most popular boys at school, always found it very easy to get girlfriends, was really good at sport, went to Cambridge with me. He had wonderful, loving parents. Some boy with incredibly good ingredients, he became a heroin addict. And you think, he had the great ingredients, but could not put them together and made a terrible life for himself. You know people like that? It's just, that's really is sad. Everything going for them, but they don't know how to put a life together. And other people, they come from divorced parents or they're orphans, being abused as, like take my father, abused as a kid, physically, became a wonderful man from a very poor background in Liverpool. A great man. And he was actually quite sick as well. He suffered from asthma and other allergies all his life. You know, he had poor ingredients, but he made a pretty good cake. Dear Ajahn, is it wrong to spay or neuter stray animals? Yeah, I think it's... I think sometimes that it can be very useful. I know we do this to any cats in our monastery, because we have like a lot of feral cats in Australia. And the cats, they destroy so much wildlife, because the cats came in boats with the English. They just, cats, they just jump on boats, they can go anywhere. And many of them just left the people's houses and went to live in the Australian bush, and they destroy so much of the wildlife. And so it's a matter of course, if ever we find a stray animal, that we look after it and care for it, but we usually spay it. We don't call it spay. You know what I said yesterday? We monasticize it. And, it's a humane little operation, and they're fine afterwards. So I can't see any problem there at all. Next question. You said we have to take care of our own happiness of all sentient beings. Otherwise, we'll burn out eventually. In the morning session, you said we should just give and should not crave. Isn't there some contradictory things here? Yeah, sometimes if you speak enough, you'll always contradict yourself. And what's actually happening there is something which Ajahn Chah used to say. I was talking about this morning. Sometimes we were wondering about what Ajahn Chah really taught. And sometimes said he taught this, and sometimes they say he taught that. And what he actually said was sometimes he said, I see someone like on a bicycle and they're leaning to the left. I say, go to the right, go to the right. Sometimes I see another person, they're leaning to the right. I say, go to the left, go to the left. So what is sometimes contradictory is just applying to different people. And we just talked about this recently, how hard it was to actually to pin down what Ajahn Chah really said. Because as one of the monks in the early days, he disrobed, but he's translated a lot of Ajahn Chah's works. Paul Breiter, you may have heard that name on some of Ajahn Chah's books. But after his 5 years as a monk, he wanted to do what we call tudong, where it is a Thai word, where you leave the monastery, carry everything you own on your back, and just wander through the forests, visiting various teachers, walking and living very simply, without any permanent home for the night. And this was a tradition, in the Thai forest tradition, after 5 years in a monastery, once you learn the basic rules, you go off and live by yourself. Or wander from place to place, learning from different teachers, visiting different monasteries, or just spending time in solitude. So this monk, Paul Breiter, he'd finished his 5 years, and he wanted to ask Ajahn Chah permission to go on tudong. But he was scared of Ajahn Chah. So one night he was listening to two other monks go up to Ajahn Chah and ask permission to go on tudong. And Ajahn Chah started talking about the beautiful things which happened on tudong. How you can spend time in solitude and get some wonderful meditation. About how you have to face your fears of tigers and ghosts. How you can actually meet these amazing monks who sometimes you don't even know exist. I know Ajahn Ñanadhamma, one of my friends who's the abbot now of the monastery over in the northeast of Thailand, who started another monastery in Khao Yai province, or Khao Yai National Park on the edge of there. And there's this old monk, I think he's 102 or something. He's been living up in those mountains for I don't know how long. And every now and again he wanders in the monastery to say hello. You've got these old hermit monks who no one knows about. And you meet these on tudong. And they were saying what a wonderful time Ajahn Chah himself had when he was on tudong. And he was praising tudong so much that he gave his monks, yeah, permission, you go. It's a wonderful thing. That's what monks should really do. And so Paul Breiter, having heard Ajahn Chah praise tudong, thought, right, now's my chance. So he asked, Ajahn Chah, can I go on tudong? Tudong, that's a stupid thing to do. Only lazy monks go on tudong. And that's what Ajahn Chah was like. Because sometimes it's a very good idea. What he would do, he would answer the person. He would never answer the question. His answer was specific to that one person. And that's why he said to these two monks, yeah, they make good use of Tudong. Go. And he's praising it. Paul Brighton, no way. You stay here. So sometimes when you say one thing, that the thing is to do, the most important thing to do in your life is not to get, but to give. But you also to be able to give to other people, to be able to serve, to be able to love, you got to spend time for yourself as well. I also did mention that. So in order to be of greatest benefit for the world, the Buddha would sometimes spend 1 or 2 weeks in silent retreat, helping no one at that time, because he was gaining his energies so after his retreat he could really serve. So to serve others, we have to serve ourselves. So that's why we count too. So I don't see it as contradictory. My partner, who has 2 daughters in Perth with his ex-wife, has once said to me, it is easy to be unconditional with your own children, but husband and wife is always conditioned. What is your view for this, or for this person who has this type of thought? Actually, there's some wisdom there. Because you do have unconditional love for your children. But very few people have unconditional love for their partner. The way you love your children and the way you love your husband or your wife is usually very different. And I don't know why that is. Because when you think about it, you don't choose your children. They come into your life and you're stuck with them. You can't take them to the hospital and say, can I exchange this one? It doesn't sleep at night. Have another one, please. Yes, you can make a good business, like children swapping. You can actually have like a mark, like not eBay, like Baby Bay. No, not eBay, eBaby, that's right. That'll be the name of it. So you can actually put your baby on eBaby. I think, like, obviously that's a very terrible thing to even suggest. But that's only a joke, please don't quote me on that, otherwise I get into big trouble. But your partner in life, you spend a lot of time and energy and thought choosing the person you're going to marry. You go out with them sometimes for years before you commit. You test them out. You check out from their friends what type of person they are. You spend more time and energy and care choosing a partner than you do choosing your car. Even with your partner, you usually test drive them several times before you commit. Come and be true. But why is it, having put so much time and care into choosing your partner, you get it wrong so often? Or you don't have unconditional love to your partner? It's strange. But really, I think that you can change the way you look at your partner and give them unconditional love, to love them like your children, or like your brother or your sister, or like your parents. To actually move them into your heart rather than keep them outside. Some partnerships actually go that far. It's not just the ordinary love of a husband to wife. It's just this beautiful love of unconditional love to your partner. You just want them to be happy. You care for them. When I see that, I realize the marriage has actually gone to the next level of unconditional love and support. It's almost like a spiritual marriage rather than just a convenience marriage. That type of love, you can always test whether that's the type of relationship you have to your wife. If it really is unconditional love, you just want her to be happy and that's the most important thing in the world to you, then imagine this. Imagine you've come here to this seminar, this Dhamma enrichment camp for the day, and you've left your wife back home. And when you go back home, you find a note on the door from your wife. The note says, "Dear ex-husband, I've run away to Phuket with your best friend for a steamy week. If that's what you read, how would you feel?" If you felt not relieved, but if you felt happy, so delighted that your wife was having even more fun with your best friend than ever.